The Packet Pushers Podcast is an independent show for network engineers by network engineers. If you haven't heard the program before, we started in April 2010 as a podcast to talk about what we're doing in our day-to-day work, deep dive on nerdy networking stuff that interests us, and just generally have a good time talking about what we do. The topics we've covered include MPLS for the enterprise, IPv6 deployment strategies, is ISIS or OSPF better, goings-on at the IETF, overlay networking and layer 2 extension protocols, emerging data center technologies, network virtualization, software-defined networking, OpenFlow. I think you get the idea. And at packetpushers.net, you can keep up with all of our content as well as subscribe via RSS or iTunes. We have a few different podcast feeds as well as a blog feed populated with content written by network engineers from around the world. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Packet Pushers, follow us on Facebook, and chat with fellow networking nerds in the Packet Pushers channel at irc.freenode.net. Contacting the show directly is as easy as an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. We answer almost all the mail, but be patient as it might take a couple of weeks or so for us to get to your message. I am Ethan Banks, a CCIE who really, really better get his research exam done soon, and you can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks and read my mental musings in blog form at packetpushers.net. My curmudgeonly co-host from the UK, Mr. Greg Farrell at Ethereal Mind, is here. And what is going on, Greg, sir?
A full day of banging on with Juniper SRX firewalls. I've been trying to decide. I've got this big Juniper SRX 5800 at the core of my network, and I've been arguing over how many SPCs I should put into it, which it seems coincidence, doesn't it?
It does seem to be coincidence because Juniper is sponsoring the show today, and we won't be hitting SRX so much as the MX router series, and Juniper has put a whole host of folks on here. Let's start with Russ Kelly. Russ is a solution architect for Juniper, and why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you do within Juniper, Russ?
I work in the platform group, the Edge Aggregation Platform Group, and looking after the MX and the M series, and my specific focus working along with Doug is to look after emerging enterprise WAN architectures and data center. So we're working to put together solutions for the current day and also working with other folk within Juniper for the solutions we have in mind for the upcoming years.
Thank you for joining us. Harry Reynolds is also joining us. And Harry is a senior test engineer with Juniper. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your role?
Well, I get to put the MX through its various paces, typically at multi-dimensional scale, which by definition means multiple services running concurrently at some high instance count. Pretty much get to see the best and the worst, if you will.
Thank you for joining us, sir. And also with us is Derek Winkworth. Now, if you're thinking, oh, Derek, like Cloud, oh, Derek, yeah, that Derek. Well, Derek now has moved on to Juniper, and he has the illustrious and lofty title of Product Manager for Junos Manageability. Derek, nice of you to be back on the show, even though you've gone over to the dark side. What does a Product Manager for Junos Manageability actually do?
The Product Manager drives respect to their focus, mine being manageability. They have ownership and they drive the roadmap and for that thing. So I would own and drive the roadmap for, you know, manageability as a facet of Junos. Is that sufficiently vague?
That is adequate. I think we get the idea. I mean, and I know part of your interest in the past, of course, has been SDN really moving forward with what the networking world is doing. So when I heard that title, I said, yeah, from some of the conversations I've had with Derek, that seems like a very logical fit. So, yeah, I get it. I'm looking forward to the products that you end up managing and what those look like. Now, last but not least, we are adding to this constellation of Juniper stars, Doug Hanks, who literally wrote the book, with some help, but wrote the book on the MX line of routers. So, Doug, why don't you introduce yourself and what you do at Juniper?
And, you know, just to add to that, Harry Reynolds was my partner in crime on the MX book, and that's our beast of burden right there. So definitely did not do that alone. But no, name's Doug Hanks, data center architect. I'm on Russell's team. We're on the solutions architecture team, and we're always coming up with use cases, deployment scenarios, and design and implementation guides. Also the co-founder of Bajug. It's a Bay Area Juniper users group, and just a quick shout-out. It's on the 16th of next month, and everyone's invited. There's no cost and no fee.
Very good. And if I remember, we'll get a link up on the blog post for this podcast about that. Hey, Doug, why don't you kick off the show? Juniper wanted to have the opportunity to talk to the Packet Pushers audience about the MX line of routers. Now, a lot of the guys that are listening to this show have a Cisco background, so they know ISR, ISR G2, maybe the ASR line, and are familiar with those. And the MX line is not going to be as familiar, so you want to give everyone an introduction of what the MX line really covers and the markets that it's focused on.
Yeah, I mean, let me give you a high-level introduction to the MX. I guess, you know, coming from a Cisco background, people like to compare it to the ASR. It's a bit difficult to do, actually, just because of the number of places that the MX actually plays. To kind of give you an example of, you know, who's buying it and what they're using it for, it could be in the enterprise edge, the core, or the aggregation. It also plays in the data center interconnect, as well as service provider edge, core, and aggregation. And we have a big emphasis on broadband and mobile backhaul as well. And that's all on one platform called the MX. So it's just kind of hard to compare it to you know, one platform on the Cisco side. I was actually want to turn it over to Derek a little bit, because I was going to say maybe one thing that's going to interest the Cisco guys is Junos, which is the operating system that the MX runs. And there's just a ton of functionality and features there that I think the Cisco guys would actually like.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually, where I worked previously, we had the MX deployed in our data center core at our access layer, at our aggregation layer, and we used it in MPLS roles. We just seemed to use it, and in the services role, actually. So we sort of used it all over the map. And it's because of how feature-rich, you know, the feature set is for the software that runs the platform. It can perform in all of those roles.
I seem to remember having a beer with you, Derek, and you actually just sat there and you went really wide-eyed and you just went, "I love Junos and MX routers. That's fantastic."
I tell you, I mean, Doug, once you use it, it's like you're hooked. I mean, I was a customer for a long time as well before I joined Juniper, kind of similar to Derek. And, I used the MX as a customer, and, you know, you put it into one location. It's like you just, you know, you fall in love with it, and you put it everywhere and let it do everything. It's just great.
No, I just remember watching Derek light up when he was talking about Junos MX. So I think it might be, you know, it must be exciting to be right there in amongst it and actually forging some part of the direction of it.
Yeah, it is, actually. I mean, Ethan was saying that my blog was kind of focused on SDN and network programmability, and that's still the case. That our view in my current role is that you know, SDN and automation kind of fold underneath manageability, right? They make the infrastructure more consumable by allowing increasing levels of complexity to sort of be encapsulated and abstracted away. When you can leverage automation SDN like in a workflow sort of framework, I was very excited about the MX because it lends itself readily to that. I mean, there's a fairly straightforward SDK on it, and it has a JunoScript API.
Well, they all run SRX. They all run Junos, right? So regardless of whether it's an SRX secure firewall platform or an MX router, they all run the same Junos operating system, and it's the same language in all of them.
I think just the fact that MX can be it can be deployed almost anywhere, it seems like. It's something, like you said, you hooked on it, you get to know it and understand it as a hardware platform. The next deployment, it's just a matter of, well, how many ports do I need? I'm going to buy an MX that does that, and that's what you do. And you get a habit, it just starts happening.
Yeah, I mean, the MX, you've got sizes of router that cover the whole range, from very small to the very large. I mean, you want to just walk down through the models real quick, I mean, or at least give someone an idea of how small versus how large that the MX architecture scales to.
Yeah, it starts off with a small router called the MX80. It's a small 2U box, and call it our mid-range. And one interesting thing we actually did with the MX80 is we scaled it down even further. So with the MX80, you get these two modules, and you can, you know, put in a 2x10 module or a 20x1 module. But sometimes it's just a little bit too big for what you need, maybe for a branch office or something like that. So we scaled down the MX80 into three different models called the MX5, the MX10, and the MX40. And it's the exact same hardware as the MX80, But the only difference is that we restrict the number of ports that you can use via a software license. So, for example, on an MX-5, you can use one module. I believe on an MX-10, you can use two modules. On the MX-40, you can use both modules plus some of the built-in 10 gig ports. So that's, we kind of classify that as our mid-range. And up from there, we get into the chassis. It's called the MX-240, the 480, and the MX-960. And respectively, that's going to be two line cards, six line cards, and 12 line cards.
And the numbers, I believe, refer to the throughput that the box can cope with, yes?
When it originally came out in 2007, yes, but we're well beyond those numbers right now.
Yeah, so a 960 isn't limited to 960 gig. You push that to a higher number.
Yeah, I believe it's like 5.7 terabits or something like that right now.
Right, right.
It's got a modular architecture inside. I remember something involving Beer and Derek, and we were talking about how the MX architecture goes together. He was explaining that there's these modular cards that can go inside it to clock it out.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. No, the chassis, they take switching fabrics. The routing engine is actually built right into the switch fabric. It's kind of like a shell / carrier. And basically, the switch fabric provides connectivity between all the different PFEs. We call them packet forwarding engines, or ASICs. And the ASICs live on the line cards. So you have three major components, the line cards, the switch fabric, and the route engine. Within each line card, there's several different options. I mean, you can get fixed port line cards, like a 16 by 10, or you can kind of go down the modular route where you can say, okay, I want a line card, but it's basically an empty shell, and you can plug different modules into that.
So you can elect to go down upgrading the switching, or you can go using the switching cards, or you can elect to upgrade the forwarding performance, the IP forwarding or routing performance, by upgrading the other cards?
Yeah, that's a bit interesting. So there are two versions of line cards. One, actually, there's three versions. There's one for routing, which basically includes routing and bridging. And then there's just a line card that focuses just for bridging. So if you're in an all-switching environment and you don't need routing, well, you can use the bridging line card. And there's also an enhanced queuing line card, which basically gives you the ability to scale out to hierarchical QoS, and kind of give you an idea of what that actually means, is that all the base line cards, they have 8 queues per port, no matter what line card it is. But as soon as you go up to the enhanced queuing line card, I think it takes you up to what, Harry? Half a million queues per line card? It's just outrageous.
That's correct, 512 queues, 512 queues.
If you're doing hierarchical queuing, you really need to be able to, especially in the carrier side. So when you're like got a Juniper MX and you've got 1,000 customers and you've got 8 queues per customer, then that's 8,000 hierarchical queues that you have to manage, and that's the sort of use case for that.
Yeah, the use case for the for that is really like you say, the hierarchical multiple tenants or customers on one physical port and going down with a lot of flexibility down multiple levels of hierarchy, doing service sets and queuing, scheduling at each one of those levels. So that's really where you can use up that number of queues, per line card, and it's with these services and subscriber services spread across the ports.
Yeah, just echoing, it's largely targeted towards layer 2 subscriber access and scaling.
Having said that, we in my previous role, even if you're a large enterprise, you have multiple applications, let's say, facing the internet, you can use the enhanced queuing card to, like, if those applications are on different, let's say, VLANs, you can use the enhanced queuing card to have granular control over the QoS for each of those applications. So, there are applications for that, even outside the service provider domain.
Sure, you just probably wouldn't need 500,000 queues.
Yeah, exactly.
But you need more than 8 per interface in a normal situation. So what I would like to drill into is we've sort of talked a little bit about the hardware, about the Juniper MX architecture. Derek, tell me, who should be buying the MX? What sort of roles is it being deployed in?
Also, everybody. because it's so deployable. I mean, look, you can even a large enterprise could even put, if they wanted, they could put MX-5s. If they have Ethernet wireline, they could put MX-5s at, I wouldn't say branch locations necessarily, but mid-sized locations. To terminate the internet, like we said earlier, you could use a data center core, data center edge, MPLS, DCI interconnect. If you wanted to run MPLS in between your data centers, which a lot of enterprises are doing, then it can, you can use it to build the MPLS portion of your network. You can, it supports MPLS over GRE. So you could, you know, whether you have layer two services from an external provider or layer three services, you can build your MPLS network, you know, on top of those services using the platform. So really, you know, that's kind of a white space problem. Who can deploy it? Well, what role can it be in? Well,
yep. So it's not targeted at a particular market. It's not targeted. It can actually fit. You know, I'll show my ignorance here and say that historically I always thought Juniper was a service provider product, and it came, you know, to some extent in my, you know, I'm an old grumpy network engineer, and, you know, we always used Cisco in the enterprise and carriers always used the Junipers. But what you're saying is that, you know, you were in an enterprise before, you know, before you took up your new role, and you're saying you used it in the enterprise full time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. When it first came out, I think there was this idea that it was, you know, be an Ethernet services platform for service providers. But even not very long after it got released, within a year and a half or 2 years, it became apparent that it had wider applicability.
Yeah, and I would say to that point, you know, that on the enterprise side, that's where we are focused a lot on, especially with these lower end MXs. And we do have a lot of customers making use of the core Junos routing functionality, and whether it be, you know, virtual routing or separation of the router and such in a traditional manner, or looking to use the other types of interfaces, because we do support the serial and ATM that allows for a greater stretch into a more dispersed or, you know, a distributed network. We have customers who want the same functionality in a much more smaller form factor, as well as maybe I'll talk about it later on, the services angle, and by that I mean the L4 to L7 services on that platform is a big focus for us, for both to replicate what we can do in the chassis-based platforms for the enterprise. So there's a lot going on with those smaller platforms on the MX.
Yeah, I think sometimes Juniper is unfairly categorized as an SP kind of vendor. I mean, it's true, we started out there, but to kind of give you guys an idea of our revenue, it's roughly half and half between enterprise and SP with the MX. So it's definitely not just an SP box. I mean, we're getting half of our revenue and half of our customers are coming from the enterprise.
I think that perception is changing across the industry as well, particularly in recent years, where not just, I know we're focused on the MX line here, but just Juniper more broadly, some of the products that have come out are really purely enterprise plays. And so
right, the switches and firewalls. Yeah.
Absolutely. The switches, the firewalls, the EX line. Now, Russ, you had mentioned something just a minute ago about the MX router that I wanted you to expand on, because someone could have latched in on and said, oh, it's an Ethernet services router, so I can only terminate Ethernet with this. But there are other types of interfaces as well. You mentioned serial and ATM. What other sorts of circuits can you put in there? And enterprise customers, I know, will be keenly interested in that, as a lot of times they're going to position a router like this as a, you know, long-haul data center edge termination device.
There's actually quite a number of picks that we support now. I don't have them on top of my head, but anything from, you know, clear channel OC3 up to OC48, channelized, a lot of ATM functionality there as well, which is what we're actually focused on for folk that are migrating still to Ethernet services. And there's a lot of ATM out there and a lot of enterprise backbones, you know, from federal to large corporates that have sort of private WAN.
So sad.
It's not gone yet.
No, it also supports the TU1s and DS3s.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah. And all of those.
Which are going to be the most common, right?
And also the multi-link services, Frame Relay and PPP for channel bonding.
Exactly, which is where we're doing a lot of our solution focus to give customers a good boilerplate approach to, you know, if I want to do, you know, link bundling and what can I do. Some of these services are moving in line and some, you know, require a services pick. And then there's that flexibility there, along with the some of the tunneling that's already supported in line with the Trio chipset that effectively is the MX80. It is an integrated line card. So a lot of these features are done in line on the platform, and we can channelize right down to DS0. So a lot of flexibility in the interface or the IO world, and it gives customers that ability to migrate slowly or however quickly they need to migrate over to Ethernet services, because that's, you know, obviously a never increasing market, but they do need the same functionality on all types of interfaces, including link bundling, as Harry pointed out.
Now, you just kind of brushed very quickly and said Trio chipset, which if you look at the heart and soul of what this router is, it's built around that chipset. Now, Doug was kind enough to let me read a preview of the book that Harry and he wrote that is going to be published fairly soon, Doug?
Yeah, it should be out, I would say, in, 2 to 3 weeks. It went off to the printer today, actually.
So early in the book, you covered Trio and what's special about it, right, fairly early in the book, because understanding how traffic flows around that router, you really got to understand Trio and what it's all about to get that. When you guys want to talk about that?
Trio really kind of revolves around three things. It's performance. We try to strive for a line rate with everything. Also in terms of scale, as like, you know, Harry mentioned, the scale is pretty important when it comes to subscriber access. And it also focuses around what we call inline services. So I guess at its heart, Trio is it's software programmable, but it's still like an ASIC. And kind of give you an example of what we mean by that. Like inline services like port mirroring or network address translation or even doing things like JFlow or IPFix, we can do that inline on the actual PFE, and we don't have to kick that packet out to a services card or what have you. We also support encapsulation like GRE, IPIP, and some logical tunnels directly in line with that chipset.
Yeah, so the magic is multiple services built into the chipset that all run at line rate. So therefore, you can get everything from fancy queuing to fancy encapsulation to just straight up forwarding, all flowing through the Trio chipset. It goes at line rate. You can kill an MX box with crazy and fancy services that you want without impacting end performance. I think that's a fair summary.
Oh yeah, that's a perfect summary. I mean, you can just kill the MX with, a terabit of forwarding traffic and services on top of that. Meanwhile, your control plane or the routing engine is going to be sitting idle.
Right. That was something that was very attractive to me with the MX is, the previous hardware that was in there supported 2, 4, 8-to-1 oversubscribed line cards. And there was a little bit of an engineering victory when we settled on the MX because there was no possible chance between engineering, analysis and requirements, in the business process from engineering analysis to product ordering for someone to insert themselves, in that process and then buy a cheaper card that it was way more oversubscribed than what was actually needed. We knew that when we got that line card in, if it was 41 gig ports, we could run 41 gig ports without choking an ASIC on that line card.
Yeah, now that's a unique feature of the Junos hardware architecture, of the MX hardware architecture, is that every time you add a line card, you add more processing power, more forwarding capability, more processing functionality.
Yeah, we put all the awesome on the line cards. So it's all the hardware queues, all the forwarding, all the inline services, it's right there compacted into the line card. Everything else is just really, really stupid. I mean, a control plane's a control plane. It handles OSPF, BGP, SNMP, et cetera, the management. And the switching fabric is just super dumb. It takes a JCell from point A to point B. But, all the awesome's in the line card.
That's important, right? Because one of the there's many different ways to build a routing engine or a routing silicon capability. And one way is to build a baseboard like a PC. You build a motherboard and then you just put line cards in it. But the actual forwarding performance is determined by the baseboard and the CPU that's on the baseboard. And then the line cards that you pop in are just dumb interfaces. So they're cheap, but you pay all the price up front. Whereas the thing that I like about the MX series is because the actual baseboard is actually a low-cost element, it doesn't actually have all the fancy silicon and all the fancy capabilities, you're basically paying for the management engine and the software license and some power supplies and a bit of metal to hold them in. And then every time you buy a line card, then you're scaling the price up according to the performance that you want. You don't have to buy all of your performance up front.
A big benefit of that is when there are new generation line cards, you don't have to do a forklift upgrade. Take advantage of the new capabilities.
That's an important thing for our MX and the customers is with the that we have is we're always pertinent to think about interoperability and line card generations being able to upgrade without forklift and mix and match. So it's a focus for us too and goes in line with what you were saying with the platform design.
Right, and that includes, I think, what's called an in-place forklift. It's you're not pulling a whole chassis out, but if you want to use them in line cars, you've got to swap all the blades out in the whole box. That's something we avoid.
That's pretty neat, actually, because that's got serious implications for how you structure your network. You can just say empty the ports out one by one, but you can still have the other half of the chassis and all the ports in over there used. Switch out the line card, and then you're back in business with a new upgraded, more better, go faster bits inside.
And kind of like a side benefit is it makes the sparing strategy pretty simple as well, because if you deploy MX in your environment, you can basically just buy the same line cards, the same modules, the same SFPs, the same routing engines, the same switch fabric, and even power supplies. They're all interchangeable.
I was wanting to dive into some of the fancy stuff that you can do. We've mentioned queuing. Talk a bit about filtering, policing, that kind of stuff. You got a whole chapter in the book on that, and then another whole chapter that's on really security-focused, more in-depth security-focused stuff like DDoS prevention. You can layer all those sorts of services on an MX box, not cripple its forwarding rate. How does all that happen? What are the features and functions in that space?
Junos has a long history of both stateful and stateless firewall filters and policing. The book focuses on stateless filters, and the Junos product line carries forward historic capabilities, so I don't want to go into things that readers might already be familiar with. We are supporting higher scaled number of policers and various points of attachment, like physical interface policers that act on all protocol families that live on an interface, as well as IFL or logical interface policers, which act on one or more protocol families that are configured on a logical interface. We've always supported transit as well as local control plane filtering. One thing that Trio brings to the table is the ability to look up to 256 bytes into all packets, and this is pre-programmed into the chipset. And it enables us to do both intelligent oversubscription, and a side effect of that is our new DDoS protection feature. The intelligent oversubscription basically recognizes control packets. And what I think is interesting is not only the number of different types of control packets, BGP, spanning tree, LACP, etc., but it recognizes them both when they're intended for the local host as well as when they're transit, such as an LSA that is being flooded in the event of, say, OSPF. And we can utilize COS over the fabric of the backplane. The backplane supports both high and low priority. And again, long story short, with no user configuration, we automatically prioritize any control plane traffic both to the local processor as well as across the control fabric or the switch fabric if it needs to be sent downstream. And that helps a lot if you're intentionally doing oversubscription, because it's one thing to oversubscribe your users and their data plane, but if that ends up causing a control plane flap, which then disrupts those users, that's, of course, a big negative. Side effect of the deep packet inspection and the ability to recognize what is in these payloads of these packets allows us to have a new feature that's supported on Trio only currently, which by definition means MX series routers. Basically, it allows the router to automatically police at ingress to the Trio chipset, and a given line card or MPC can have multiple chipsets. So on a given line card, there can be multiple policing points at ingress as it comes off the wire. We police again at the line card level, which is the aggregate of those PFEs. And then we police yet a third time when the line card sends that traffic to the control plane or the routing engine itself. And this is all independent and in addition to the classic stateful or stateless firewall filters and policers that you may already have on your loopback interfaces. Again, this is something that's there by default. It's out of the box. You don't have to configure it to make advantage, to take use of it, but you might certainly want to adjust the various parameters to suit your network's needs. I don't have the exact count handy, but I believe it recognizes some 80 different protocols. We're talking all sorts of sub-protocols within families like PPP, it's recognizing PADI and PADR messages, and it's able to set different policing thresholds for those various sub-message types. And again, the net effect is it tends to prevent your control plane from being overwhelmed either with maliciously, intentionally generated traffic or excessive amounts of control plane traffic that might perhaps stem from some network failure or unpredictable event that's happened somewhere in your network.
I'll add just a little bit to that, like going backing up to the filters. Basically, within Trio, everything's going to happen within one pass of that chipset. You know, we'll do input behavior aggregation, we'll do input filters, policers, we'll do a route lookup, we'll also do an output filter, an output policer, output schedulers, the class of service rewrite. And this all happens right there in the ASIC within one pass. So it's very low latency and pretty quick. It's all line rate.
The issue that comes up in a lot of people's minds, which we've kind of touched on before, is as soon as I add all this stuff, my router is going to slow down. And that's obviated with the MX architecture, which is pretty interesting because that's one of those things where I've been in situations where, okay, we've got this router sitting at the edge and we want to add these services. And then everybody in the room says and goes, I don't think we want to do that because, you know, and everybody's thinking lower throughput or strange things are going to happen, unpredictable results as the data streams go through the router and get passed on to the other side. And with the MX, a non-issue because of the way it is architected. Now, Doug, you had mentioned also wanting to talk about the switching functionality.
So, yeah, the MX has a ridiculous amount of switching features as well. One of the key points is that we've added a lot of switching functionality for the SP. But I also found out that these switching features can be used in the enterprise as well. I'll kind of give you an example of what I'm talking about is that we can actually scale way beyond 4,000 VLANs on the MX. Typically on a top of rack switch, you know, you can use, you know, 4,000 VLANs and you call it a day. But there's a concept called virtual switches on the MX. And basically think of it as a layer 2 VRF. So for example, you can create a VRF called A. And you can create, you know, 4,000 VLANs within that one VRF. And you can do the same thing again over and over with VRF B, VRF C, and VRF D. Another interesting concept is how we actually build bridge domains. We have a bunch of different modes. So, for example, there's a mode called none, all, range, and it supports one tag and dual tags. And kind of give you an idea of why there's different modes. It's because of the VLAN normalization. So in the SP world, we usually have to, you know, take a certain type of VLAN ID on the ingress, but actually change and rewrite that on egress. And instead of having to program that by hand, we've created shortcuts with bridge domains. So, for example, if you create a bridge domain, which is just a VLAN, and you have a two tags on that, because like if you go back to, again, a top of rack switch, you usually say, okay, this is VLAN 200 with a VLAN ID of 200. Well, on the MX, you can go create a VLAN, but you say instead of VLAN 100, this is actually VLAN inner 100 and outer 500, for example. That may kind of blow your mind at first, but you can do things like that. So,
well, it sounds like Q&Q, but is it more special than that?
It is. So it's a VLAN and it's Q&Q. And depending on what interfaces that you plug into that bridge domain, it automatically creates a VLAN normalization. So again, if you have that Q&Q bridge domain, and let's say you plugged in an interface that just .1Q, it'll automatically pop off that VLAN ID on that interface, and it will push two VLAN tags onto the packet on egress. And when that packet comes back to that one interface, it'll pop off those two Q&Q VLAN IDs, and it'll push back the original .1Q onto that interface. So you can do a bunch of stuff like that on the MX.
The way VLAN tags are handled, they kind of borrow the concept from MPLS of push, pop, and swap. And you can it can be Q&Q if you want it to be. You can and do VLAN translation in the process, and it's very cool actually what you can do with that using VLAN policies that you can do more advanced things with VLAN policies you apply to the interface.
Yeah, it's a very flexible architecture customers use. I think in layer two environments, and you know, view and our focus on DCI to use like the bridge domain to allow the scale the WAN side, so the VPLS instance could just be say the bridge domain VLAN, but within that you have all of those customers' VLANs being transported, but you don't have a plethora of VPLS instances across the WAN. So there's many use cases and where that flexibility and functionality can be taken advantage of.
One that always kind of blows my mind is that you can create a bridge domain slash VLAN, and you can say, okay, this is called none. And what that means is that any interface that you put into that bridge domain with a mode of none, it'll strip all VLAN tags, no matter if it's, you know, .1, .AD, or whatever it is. It'll take off all VLAN IDs, and it'll flood, filter, and forward with untagged. And if it goes from interface 1 to interface 2, but those two interfaces had, you know, different VLAN IDs or what have you, it'll restore that on the ingress and egress. And kind of give you an example on the scale. So I believe you can create like 32,000 or 64,000 bridge domains with a type of none. And you just get crazy scale, and you can do some really interesting things with that.
It's like someone should have called you guys before the whole VXLAN thing came out. It's like this is a different way to go about it.
Sounds like you missed a trick there. And one of the other things I wanted to ask about was I'm sitting here looking at your Juniper MX series book online, and I see that the description talks about multi-chassis lag. How does that go together on the MX series?
Just another feature that we support on the MX, and actually QFX as well. It works just like any other multi-chassis lag that you may have used before. We support active standby and active-active. And I guess the synopsis of MC lag is that you basically take two separate chassis. They both operate independently, but on a downstream device like a Tor, it would appear as one logical LACP link. So if you did want to have two control planes in your core, but have that one logical link from the perspective of the Tor, it works out nicely. So you can actually forward traffic across both links.
Yeah, and then there's some magic protocol you've got between the two MX chassis that are stitching that together so that the MLAG works transparently. Is that your own? I mean, you do MLAG in other boxes too in Juniper, like the EX series. Is it all the same code?
Control plane wise, yeah, it's exactly the same code, and it's basically just trying to synchronize the state of LACP and some MAC learning and some things like that. It's not very difficult, so it's a pretty lightweight protocol that we've designed to scale out. Right now, we support up to boxes in the MC lag, and yeah, I mentioned you can do active-active or active standby. Active standby, you get a bit more deterministic traffic flow. So you know, it might always flow down the left of your network topology versus, you know, either or depending on the hash function of the Tor. People do like both. We mostly see active standby, but actually active-active is actually growing in popularity right now.
Now, right along the lines of MLAG is the other redundancy options that you've got. I mean, if you want to keep your control plane separate, great, but you also do MX virtual chassis.
Yeah, so if you think of MC lag and you reverse everything I just said, that's a virtual chassis. So virtual chassis is kind of like a confederation of chassis acting as a single chassis. By itself, it sounds pretty simple, but where it gets really interesting is the way that Juniper actually does that. For example, if you take two chassis and you want to create one chassis out of that, it becomes a very interesting problem to solve. And there's kind of different ways to approach that problem. The most common and the easy way to do that is just to create scripting in the back end to make it look and feel as one chassis. But Juniper actually did something completely different with virtual chassis. We took the control plane and the routing engine and all those functions associated with that, like graceful routing engine restart or nonstop routing and nonstop bridging. And we actually implemented that between chassis. Because typically within a single chassis, when you turn on GRES or NSR, that happens between two routing engines on the same chassis. But with a virtual chassis, that now actually happens between two different chassis. So you have kernel synchronization happening across the wire from chassis A to chassis B. And when you actually log on to that device, it looks, it feels, and it is, for all intent and purposes, a single chassis. And effectively, the chassis become big line cards. So when you do like a show a show chassis hardware or show interface terse, you'll see all the line cards, all the PICs, all the SFPs, and it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, and just to further within the architecture of VC, there's no need for any sort of special connectivity between the two. You can just use any onboard interface, any of the line cards to connect the two chassis. Currently on the MX, it's two that can make up a virtual chassis. And again, to the same vein as the question before about the EX, it's very much the same implementation, but more EXs, I think up to eight, are actually supported in their virtual chassis implementation. So campus environments, we see both being employed. And of course, we get this question a lot with regards to simplifying routing topologies with virtual chassis. And then just the discussion around separate control planes versus a unified one, all available there now.
You can do whatever you want. Enough rope to hang yourself, as they say, is also a possibility. I mean, just because you could take a couple of MXs and have them be hundreds of miles away, connected by a circuit, and you could make that be a virtual chassis, that probably wouldn't be the wisest design option. I mean, I'm imagining typically you're going to do that in a data center with very good and redundant connectivity.
You know, there are obviously limitations with regards to round trip times. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is, but it's tens of milliseconds regards to the messaging between the chassis. So we see it in campus metro areas, and yeah, obviously within data centers where it's being employed.
I mean, that's a good point, because I mean, with the MX and virtual chassis, you don't require a special routing engine. You don't require special cables like you do with the EX. It's all built into the Trio chipset. It works out nicely.
So there are lots of things about Junos. I mean, aside from the fact that the CLI is consistent across about, well, every single box they make, Junos CLI is pretty interesting. It's the same everywhere. And one of the big things about Junos is that it's the same on every device. Now, before I launch off into my next question, I just want to point out that personally, I've been trying to work my way through the Junos Day 1 guides. So if you're somebody who's been wondering about how hard it would be to maybe learn Junos and how to master that CLI, Juniper has a bunch of introductory booklets, I guess is the best way to describe them, called Day 1. And it's like Day 1 learning Junos for, you know, how to get started on it and stuff like that. Now, the one I want to draw your attention to is there's one which is particularly called Junos Day 1 Learning Event Automation. Now, you'll have heard us talk a lot about SDN and network programmability and reducing the workload around things. And Junos particularly has its own XML-based language, although you don't really notice that it's XML once you get stuck into it, so don't get scared by that. And this talks about how you can create scripts that actually deploy commands onto routers in a sort of a very universal way. And I got a lot of ideas about different ways of handling Junos in ways that you haven't thought of, using the Slacks templates and the Slacks policies, and that'll all make sense when you read it. So if you want to get a bit more scratch away at how Junos could make your life be different, then go off and have a look at the Juniper Day 1 books. You just search on their website and you'll find them up. They also have a bunch of other PDF files which I've been using to try and master Junos. It hasn't worked very well for me because of a lack of time. Say hello to the packet pushers, people, because that's where my time goes. But get a hold of those. But the question I wanted to ask, probably, Derek, is the big thing, is that there's a bunch of scaling features in the Junos hardware platforms that we haven't talked about. And one of them is this LSIS feature that I wanted to call out in Junos. Can you tell me a bit more about that one?
There's actually sort of multiple layers of virtualization inside of Junos. On top of basic VLANs and virtual switch instances and virtual routers, there's also this concept of LSIS, which is one layer higher than virtual routers, in that you can sort of logically divide a Junos device up into multiple Junos devices, each with multiple virtual routers. And you can actually tie user accounts on for administrative purposes to the logical system. So when like a particular user logs into the box, they get dropped into their logical system, and that's the view of the world they have.
Yeah, it's like a VMware for the MX.
That's a very cool feature, particularly, by the way, if you're studying for certification or you're doing lab work, because suddenly if you're like, wow, it'd be really cool if I had eight MXs to do testing with or to study with, you can divide one up into 16 LSIS.
No, that's a good point, because like when you're doing your JNCA or what have you, you can use LSIS as well as logical tunnels. So you don't even need multiple boxes or even cables. You just use all the virtualization in the MX. And it's kind of interesting, because in our next Bay Area Juniper usage group on the 16th, we have an event called Beer and Gear. And I'm basically bringing in one of the small 2U MXs. And we have a 15-node service provider network And we'll be running BFD, ISIS, MPLS, VPLS, Layer 3 VPNs, Compella tunnels, Martini tunnels, the whole nine yards on one box. And it simulates an entire SP network.
On one box.
On one box.
It's like a certification junkie's dream to be able to pull together something like that, let you do any lab exercise you want.
It has like fast reroute. I mean, all the goodies that you'd expect, it's all right there at line rate. It's just amazing.
So ELSIS is very cool, which makes me wonder, are there other very cool things coming down the line that Juniper cares to share with the audience?
Actually, I think it was at the Packet Pushers OpenFlow Symposium, we announced that we had OpenFlow support for the MX, and that's still available, OpenFlow version 1.0. And, I can't really go into roadmap. I'll say that Juniper is going to continue to support OpenFlow on the MX, and, certainly you can expect some announcements that way coming soon. Over the next month or 6 months or so. The MX is such a powerhouse and is deployed in so many different ways for us that, there are actually a number of pieces of hardware, features, et cetera. It's definitely a platform that if you invest now, it's going to evolve and there's going to be new features and new modules you can look at in the future. In my opinion, it's definitely a safe investment. Actually, in Juniper's opinion, it's a safe investment. But
well, in other words, there's a long-term commitment that Juniper has to this platform. So if you buy this, it's not going to go away and get replaced by something new, and you'll be like, oh, wish I should have bought that other thing.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, Juniper has a very hard time EOL on products. To give you an example, we still have our original router called the M40 out in some production networks right now, and that was released back in 1997. So it's here for the long haul, yes.
This seems like a very full podcast. This is one of those I'm going to have to go back and listen to each section that we covered, because we covered a lot of territory. The MX router, it's not just, oh, it's a router. You plug it into the edge of your network and it routes stuff. This is a very full-featured, feature-rich platform that does a whole lot of stuff at line rate and slots in really anywhere in your network that you might need a device that can do this kind of stuff. It's structured to fit in anywhere that you need it. So this was an excellent, interesting, and one of those mind-expanding kind of programs where you learn about a product, a whole bunch of stuff that you didn't know before. So I want to thank all of you guys for coming on to talk about it, Russ and Harry and Derek and Doug. Any contact information that you wish to share with the audience, like how to follow you on Twitter, if you guys blog anywhere, shoot me an email with information. I'll be sure to post it in the blog notes so that folks that listen to the show that might want to follow you can do that. And, of course, Greg, at Ethereal Mind on Twitter and etherealmind.com, and me at EC Banks on Twitter and blogging at packetpushers.net. And to all of you, thanks for listening to this sponsored show by Juniper. We thank Juniper for sponsoring the program. And you can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers. And also, home base for us is packetpushers.net, so go there to read blogs by our growing Packet Pushers community, subscribe to our RSS feeds, and if you like, donate to the show. Email your questions or comments about this sponsored show to packetpushers@gmail.com, and remember that too much networking would never be enough.